Hello and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, and this is my co-host and colleague, Sam.
Hi there, Sam Wong, professor of neuroscience and molecular biology, also faculty associate in law and public affairs, and founder of the Princeton Election Consortium.
If there's one period in American history that I hear discussed often these days, sometimes for comparisons, it's this period we call the Gilded Age in American history, the latter part, the post-Civil War era leading into the 20th century, all kinds of issues, intense partisanship, rampant wealth and inequality, corruption, rapid changes in the economy, immigration, urbanization, racial division, and much more. They're all concerns from that era, which obviously are being discussed again today as people search for a better understanding of where we are, how we reached this place, and what the future might hold for us. And regardless of the comparisons, the years between 1865 and 1896, which we will discuss today, are simply fascinating as a moment in themselves when many of the foundations of modern society were set into place. Today we have with us one of the best historians in American history. Really, it's an honor to have him on our show, Richard White, the Margaret Byrne Professor of American History at Stanford University, to discuss his new book, The Republic for Which It Stands, The United States During Reconstruction and the Gilded Age, 1865 to 1896, which is part of the Oxford University Press series on American history, which has included many, many classics, and this one will join that list. Richard is the author of many wonderful books, including Railroaded, The Transcontinentals and the Making of Modern America, The Middle Ground, Indians, Empires, and Republics in the Great Lake Regions, and It's Your Misfortune and None of My Own, A New History of the American West. He's won many prizes for his work and for his scholarship, including the MacArthur Fellowship and the Guggenheim Fellowship. And he's one of those historians, Sam, that if you go to graduate school in history, you will read, enjoy, and discuss his books at one time or another. So, Professor White, welcome to our show.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here, Julian, Sam.
Maybe we can start. I know this is part of a book series, so everyone writes about a different period. But can you maybe just discuss the chronology, this period from the end of the Civil War through 1896? Why is this a holistic period in your mind in American history?
Well, you know, the dirty secret is it was just given to me. I mean, the way a series works is that it's the last book, James McPherson's, it's not the last book, but the book prior to mine, ends in 1865. So I have to pick up with Reconstruction. I decided to end it in 1896 because so much is different after 1896. And the challenge is to make Reconstruction and the Gilded Age, which, as you know, historians usually treat separately, into a coherent whole. And the more I looked at it, the more I realized that they really were, that the in terms of the chronology, of course, the Gilded Age begins with the kind of corruption that starts in the Civil War and then flows out, the rising inequality that comes at the same time. And this overlaps with Reconstruction. The other thing, as I found, is that the key figures in Reconstruction were very often the key figures in the Gilded Age. Some of them are totally forgotten now, like Tom Scott. But the two are intertwined all the way through. And so what I decided to do was, instead of doing a Reconstruction section and doing a Gilded Age section, I made them flow together.
And the two themes two of the themes, there's many that are pronounced besides westward expansion. The first is corruption, which you've written about in your other book. And the second is inequality. And again, that's layered over the story of immigration, of Native Americans. How do corruption and inequality figure into this period?
Well, you know, for me, and I think it will probably be one of the more controversial parts about the book, is that I adopt a kind of analysis which actually was pretty prevalent at the time, is that the inequalities of wealth in the United States come from government favoritism. And government favoritism itself can spawn corruption. And that the anti-monopolists, who are the key reformers in the period that I'm talking about, the anti-monopolists always contend the great wealth will always come when, in fact, the government favors one group over another group. And in a sense, this is an old Jacksonian kind of analysis. And their major examples of this would be things like the tariff. Andrew Carnegie is very clear that without the tariff and without his ability to maintain the tariff, he would not have been able to dominate the steel industry. Subsidies to the railroads and to corporations, the kind of decisions that are going to be made which will favor corporations and companies over labor. All of these things are going to be the influence of government and business going together, which is not to deny that many of these businessmen were not people of real ability, but what gave them the leverage was their ability to influence the government, and the government is going to be influenced in part because of the rampant corruption of the period. And the rampant corruption of the period is also built in to another kind of analysis which I adopted from Nicholas Perillo, a political scientist, and that during this period, much of the government is run not by a bureaucracy, but by what he calls fee-based governance. The governance is going to be, in effect, outsourced to private parties in which they will collect fees for enforcing the law and for taking on government responsibilities. And this, too, is going to feed the rampant corruption of the period.
But that corruption and inequality, that's also in the face of another feature of that time, which is technological disruption. So we've already gotten into a little bit the topic of westward expansion, but it's also a time when there are fortunes to be made by creating industries. And so it feels like another major story here is just the enormous expansion in American wealth, at the expense of various communities. And it feels like that's another big part of this that maybe affected people like Carnegie.
Well, there's going to be, of course, technological innovation, but much of the technological innovation is also going to have this kind of legal basis. One of the things that people ignore is the way the patent system works, and it can cut both ways. But before this, you had technology is going to be dominated by tinkerers, by people who, in fact, make small adjustments to existing technologies, not by huge, great advances. And what you're able to do is if you can, in fact, take things which have been the sort of common intellectual property and turn them into private property, then you can make a great deal of money from doing this. Westinghouse is a good example. I mean, Westinghouse is very good at mastering the patent system and turning it to his own ability. So how technological advance works depends a lot on the social political context of what's going on, because there's no reason that just because society advances technologically that the benefits of that are going to accrue to simply a small group of people, which is what ends up happening.
I guess I'm referring to the fact that the type of technological innovation that was available at the time, whether it be the advent of electricity, the rise of large-scale manufacturing, these are things that were specific to that time. And this corruption that you're talking about is directed at that. And if I think about the current time, I never know whether I'm stepping on a landmine to ask a historian to say, well, what about the current time? Like, I feel like I'm going to like blow myself up here. But if we look at the current time and we look at the kinds of innovations that are available today, those innovations, I don't know, some of them are financial innovations and some of them are innovations in certain sectors. And so how did this interaction between corruption and the advances of the time feed one another?
Well, if we take, the financial one is a very interesting one, Sam, because what you do is if you look at finances then and now, it's essentially about the control of information. You make money by having information before somebody else has it and being able to use it. You don't need to keep that information forever. You just have to be able to monetize it, to have it long enough that you can turn it into money. And in the Gilded Age, much of the corruption, the financial corruption, comes from the control of financial information. And then one of the best things you can do is if you know the government is going to do something before somebody else knows it, it doesn't even matter if the government does it or not, but you can make other people believe it, you can get financial benefits from it. So the ability to manipulate stock markets, to manipulate bond markets because you have information, to hide bad information, to promote good information, these kinds of things are precisely what leads to so much of the financial corruption then and now. That if that we think of the information revolution as being a modern phenomena, but it is happening right after the Civil War. It doesn't move as fast, but in their terms, it moves tremendously fast.
And what was the role of government favoritism in tilting the playing field there?
Oh, the basic thing would be is if you can get into Congress, let's say you have a congressman introduce a bill, and this bill probably has no chance of passing, but you have a congressman introduce a bill which says you're going to investigate railroad corruption, and you aim this at a particular set of railroads. If you can do that, you're going to find that that stock of those railroad companies is going to fall, and you can do two things. You can either sell short and make money on it, but if you're somebody like Jay Gould and you want to take over those railroads, what you do is you knock that down, you move in, you take control of the railroad, the bill goes away, and you have basically used the government to get your own financial ends. These kinds of things go rampant throughout the period.
But back then, it feels like it's factionalized, where either party could go after a company. Maybe I'm misreading I'm thinking about today's time in which we currently have parties that are quite separated by issues, where you would never imagine, say, I don't know, you would never imagine a Republican going after the gun industry, or you would never imagine a Democrat going after unions.
Yeah, you're perfectly right. That in the 19th century, what you're going to find is that the parties themselves are not particularly ideological.
See, that's fascinating to me, just the idea that you could be partisan. And we haven't gotten to that yet. Partisan yet, a little agnostic about exactly what issues you care about. I find that, I'd love to hear your take and your detailed knowledge about that.
Sure. And in a way, you probably won't find it so mysterious because we still have elements of that today. Your political loyalty is going to come from your ethnicity, your religion, your section, your attitude, which side you were on in the Civil War. And it's going to be very, very hard to shift those away. Now, that doesn't mean that, in fact, you might not be conservative in other issues or an anti-monopolist in other issues, but essentially who you are determines how you vote. And there's some of that still today. I mean, I come from a family where it would be very hard for me to ever imagine not voting Democratic, but I probably would on other issues not vote at all. But on the other hand, Republican goes against the way I was brought up. And there are Republicans who I can admit in the same, I can admire in the same way that they hold the same kind of values. So there still is a bedrock of that, I think, in American politics. But that is different from a kind of ideological shift because the ideology now tends to go with many of the people who hold these kind of basic values tend to be the conservative or tend to be liberal. But there, those two things were much less tightly connected.
And one thing that's similar between that time and now, just to refocus on this period, is it was a period of very close elections. I think that we don't necessarily, speaking as an election nerd, I look back and I think, before our lifetimes, two out of the three elections in which the person who got fewer votes became president, Rutherford Hayes, and then I believe Benjamin Harrison. And so right. It was a time when elections, at least starting in 1876, were very close. So it feels like, I wonder whether that's related somehow to this corruption and to this partisanship that you've written about.
Yeah, it certainly is, because what we'd expect coming out of the Civil War is we'd have a long period of Republican dominance. But that's over by 1874, which is a disastrous election for the Republicans. And after that, it's closely balanced. But we have to remember that the closely balanced comes because of the success of Southerners suppressing the black vote. If, in fact, black people could vote, this would have been a period of overwhelming Republican dominance. So the one thing we have to remember is the close elections are going to be based, in fact, on a kind of electoral corruption in which black people are deprived of their vote in the South. That's what creates the solid South. That's what creates the balance to the North. And that means that there's going to be a series of relatively few states. Again, you're right. It's very much like today. You can take Indiana. You can take New York. You can take Connecticut. And these are going to be the states in Ohio, too, which are going to determine the election. And these are states in which there's going to be rampant gerrymandering. There's going to be constant corruption, particularly in places like New York, because if you carry these states, you will probably dominate the national election. And the difference is going to be that today we really do have national parties, but in the 19th century, these are still going to be largely state and local parties, which come together once every 4 years to elect a president. But in those years, yeah, these are going to be corrupt elections, but they're going to be a kind of focused corruption on the particular states, which everybody knows at the beginning are going to determine the outcome.
Did to shift to a little different topic that you write about, a lot of the second part of the book is about people moving around, and you have a chapter called, I think, People in Motion, and there's two kinds of movements that are very pronounced in this period. One are the immigrants who are coming here from abroad, and the second is the movement of people to the West, which is one of the subjects you've been studying your whole career. How did those two dynamics intersect?
Well, in some ways, they're going to be the same dynamic. I mean, what people forget is that much of the settlement of the Western United States is going to be by immigrants to the United States. That, you know, California is going to be a very, very heavily immigrant state. So is North Dakota, South Dakota, Nebraska. I could run down the line. So many of the immigrants who are coming in from Europe actually move west. And the other way they intersect is that many of the immigrants who move west are moving into cities. I mean, San Francisco is going to be far and away the largest city in the American West, and it's largely going to be a city of German immigrants and Irish immigrants. And there's going to be German Jewish immigrants, but they're going to be, I mean, essentially classified as German during that time. So partially these two things overlap. The other thing I realized, and this was kind of humbling for me as a Western historian, is that when I began to count, by 1890, if you had taken the population of New York City, you had taken the population, including Brooklyn, taken Chicago and taken Boston, you would have had roughly as many people as there were in the entire Western United States, with the exception of San Francisco. So the growth of cities really is something which is much, much larger than the movement into the American West. The American West becomes, to go back to another topic, a Republican stronghold, because the Republicans managed to balance the Democrats' control over the House very often because of their dominance of the South, with the domination of the West because there are very few people out there, but they still all get two senators.
And when the immigrants settle, or the migrants settle in the West in the cities, are the patterns of life there comparable to the cities that we've studied more frequently in New York or Chicago, with the same kind of ethnic enclaves form, or is it different what you see with Western immigrants in the West?
I think there's going to be a difference, and again, it's a difference that might actually continue over into my own childhood. The difference in the West is I think there are going to be much broader lines, that the kinds of immigrant enclaves in the East are going to be more finely divided. It's going to be, you know, when I grew up was born in New York City, went out to Long Island, the question everybody used to ask me to determine who I was is, where are you from? And what they meant by where are you from is where my grandparents were from. Mm-hmm. When I moved to the West Coast, by the time I was a pre-teenager, nobody cared where my grandparents were from. They cared whether I was going to be white, Latino, or black. There are much broader distinguishing characteristics. And I think that was true in the West from very early. They draw these lines about, are you white? Are you non-white? Are you Catholic? Are you Protestant? And not the kind of fine divisions you had in the East. So there are going to be filters in the West, but they're much coarser filters.
And so what kinds of divisions were there? I mean, it's hard. This is going to sound naive, but say, for instance, among groups that we would now call white, how separated were these groups at that time, either politically or I guess socially?
They are going to merge, I think, much more quickly in the West. I mean, what you're going to find is that there's going to be an ethnic division for the first immigrants, but people intermarry very, very quickly. And you begin to get a kind of general whiteness over much of the West. You know, this is one of the things I concentrate on in the book, is the idea of the home, which sounds like a very simple idea, but it becomes a way in which Westerners and people in the East can classify different groups. if in fact you can support a home, this idea of a gendered home in which a wife takes care of the home, the husband provides for and protects the home, then you can count as an American and become, even if you're not white, sort of honorary white. One of the struggles for black people is to in fact prove that they can have homes. But if you're another group, if you become, the best example would be the Chinese, who are cast as a threat to the home. They don't form their own homes. They undercut the white home. Indians are cast as a threat to the home. If you're cast as a threat to the home, then you fall outside the general set of protections for American citizens, and you become grouped as not only un-American, but you can't possibly become an American.
And the idea there is that say, Chinese, for instance, are migrants who live alone, who are workers, because I thought didn't that community have families?
What you have here is overwhelmingly male migration. Mm-hmm. One of the first things whites concentrate on is this is a population that's 90% male. They concentrate on, and this is not just true of the Chinese, but many immigrants, their ultimate goal is to send money back to China and to go home. That's not unique to them, but this becomes a kind of assault on them for simply not really wanting to stay here. They work for lower wages. They undercut the ability of white men to support their home. What you're getting is a series of arguments which sound very, very similar to the kinds of arguments that are going to be made against immigrants today. They originate in the 19th century largely in a kind of Sinophobia, this hatred of the Chinese, which develops in California but spreads all across the West.
I see. So, for instance, migrant workers today, like Hispanics Latinos who come to the United States, that kind of thing?
Yeah. I mean, what you could have is every single thing, which is anti-immigrant rhetoric today, you could take that back to the 19th century and apply it to the Chinese, and I don't think you would find much difference at all. Drugs, got it. Undercut the family, got it. Violent sexual crimes, got it. These are the kinds of things that you're going to hear over and over again.
So can I ask if you bring together the treatment of Native Americans and the treatment of ex-slaves in the post-Reconstruction period, it's a pretty bleak picture. And from reading your book, the promise of Reconstruction is lost, and we move in the opposite direction very quickly as we move into the end of the 19th century. What's the explanation for that? I mean, what is your take on why the country abandoned some of that effort from Reconstruction on both of these fronts and others?
You know, first of all, what I'd say is that, leaving aside, because I make a separation, you're right to group Indians and freed people, and I do group them, but there is a distinction between them. Indians did not want to be incorporated into the United States by and large. Black people, by and large, did. So you have an attempt to create a homogeneous citizenship, as I say. And that attempt is going to fail. And in many ways, it's a very noble attempt. It's one we're still continuing with today, that if you are an American citizen, the federal government will enforce your rights no matter where you are in the United States. And it does not depend on your color, your gender, or anything else. So at this time, it's largely black and white. Gender and other groups are going to come in later. But it's a noble attempt. And it's going to fail in the South for, I think, quite particular reason. I'm quite taken by the kind of argument that historians have made recently that the big mistake and the mistake that condemned Reconstruction from the very beginning was withdrawal of the United States Army from the South way too rapidly. That if, in fact, you had left in garrisons, which would have been difficult to do, and the federal government had actually enforced the kind of laws that it had, Reconstruction would have turned out very, very differently. But instead, what you have is a government with a great deal of power on the books, but very little real instruments to exercise that authority.
But wasn't that the deal in 1876 that the feds would leave? I thought the deal was get out of the South and leave us alone and you can have your president. But of course, you know, I'm just a science geek, so I don't really know.
Yeah, in this case, you are a science geek.
Yeah, okay. No, so set me straight, because this is now we get to discover. I apologize. Now, help me.
Yeah, now we get to discover is that 1876 is 11 years after the end of the Civil War.
Right. That I knew.
It happened. Yeah, and what
that's subtraction. I can do that.
We're in the same page there. But what happened is the troops were being withdrawn by 1866-67. 1876 wouldn't have mattered if you had left the troops in long enough that it did sustain the kind of governments that came up. The problem is by 1876, there are very few troops left in the South. And in most of the places, they can do very little to protect those elections. That's why there's such violence and chaos in the South. When the troops come back in is when Grant brings them into South Carolina. And in other cases where Reconstruction governments act forcibly, you can put down the Klan. You can put down white terrorism. But most of the time, you do not have the ability to do it. So by 1876, in some ways, it's too late. That Ruth
I see. So that's just consolidating the thing that had been happening for a while.
Right, right. And Hayes makes a mistake, but it's a mistake that really the game was over by then.
So was there a myth of reconciliation? What led to this precipitous withdrawal from the South? It just looking back, you make it sound like, gosh, major judgment error there.
Well, these people aren't idiots. There's two things that happened is that in 1866, the United States is about to go bankrupt. I mean, this is a really expensive war. One of the things they're really worried about is we have to cut down government expenditures very, very quickly, and the major government expenditures are going to be on the Army. So there's a great deal of pressure to simply, I mean, they're selling off cavalry horses. I mean, you're trying to enforce Reconstruction, and you're selling off all the horses. These kinds of things happen very quickly. The other thing is it's been a long war, and like any long war, especially with a volunteer army, people want to go home.
Right. It was ruinous. I mean, just people on long deployments and hundreds of thousands of people dying.
So they want to go home. And the other thing is, well, you still had some troops you could use, but they're going to be black troops. And there's still going to be a kind of racial racism that pervades the country, that enforcing Northern victory with black troops is going to be very, very hard to do. So there are real obstacles in front of this, but I don't think they were insurmountable obstacles because you don't need the whole army. And you could have reorganized the army. When you do reorganize it, you deploy it to the West against Indians. You don't keep it in the South. Even Phil Sheridan says this. I'm not going to fight Indians. You know what? Well, the real need here is that in Texas, they are murdering freed people and they are murdering white unionists. This is where I need the army. But instead, they deploy it to the West.
Were there reform movements pushing against some of the trends you're talking about or some aspects of American society that were effective?
They could have been effective. I mean, one of the things that struck me is how powerful the courts are in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. Many of the reform movements, many of the Reconstruction laws are going to be cut down by the courts. And they're going to be, the odd thing is, the Republican appointees who undercut Republican Reconstruction laws. And the other one is that the anti-monopolists, by and large, did win elections. Their ability to win elections is very, very impressive. But many of the things that they push through are going to be cut down by the courts. They're also going to be perverted by the courts. Like the Sherman Antitrust Act is always going to be a weak act, but they never intended it to be against labor unions. But that's how it's going to be used. So the ability of the courts to both undercut anti-monopolist reforms, particularly in the states, and their ability to undercut reform movements in the cities is going to be very, very strong. So I think I would say a lot of this is democracy in many ways did work in the Gilded Age, that you do have people identifying the issues. And one of the things that struck me is that discussion about issues in the 19th century is in some ways much more sophisticated than what we have today. And the people do vote their interests, but what is small L liberals capture the courts and undercut the power of the government. It's going to be the 20th century before that battle is going to be won.
One could easily imagine such mechanisms today. We have many Republican jurists. The Supreme Court is majority Republican appointed and is almost certainly going to shift more in that direction in the next year or two. And so those are, you know, some of these people like, I don't know, Gorsuch or Roberts are pretty young. And so even if there were an electoral swing in U.S. politics, let's just hypothetically say there were, it feels like there's that same inertia, right? People who stick around for decades on the court who maintain whatever values and priorities they come in with. So how much of this is back then is appointees who stick around in office for a few decades, even though the public mood has changed?
A lot of it is that. But it's also going to be... a change in the legal profession. I think one of the things that happens, particularly as a political movement begins to face electoral defeat, what they can do is create bastions in these institutions which people serve for life, as you say. So if you put people in, even though the whole politics of the country begins to change, then you get exactly the phenomena that you're describing. And I think we could see that again. I mean, we've seen it not only in the late 19th century, we saw it during the New Deal, too.
Right, because what you're describing sounds very familiar, because if you look at how millennials vote, if you look at demographic tendencies in current American life, it feels like progressive priorities and liberals, at least, you know, if you look at what people under the age of 30 think, it feels like there is a move by current definitions to the left. And yet there are these, pretty vigorous guys like Gorsuch, and feels like they're going to stick around for a while.
Yeah, it's one of the reasons why millennials should understand how this system works. And that a lot of the things that happen today is why history matters. I mean, it might be that you think, okay, well, in 10 years, we're going to take this over. Well, in fact, things are going to be in place because they've happened in the past. They're not going to go away easily.
And what about, while we're on that topic, you talk about the difficulties of the anti-monopolists. This is a little bit outside the scope of your book, but towards the end of that period, and as the Gilded Age transitions into the Progressive Era, what made that possible? Because you're talking about what seems like a pretty bleak period in many ways in American politics, what Painter has called this idea that people thought they were standing at Armageddon. So mm-hmm. So what allowed that to change? Or did it change?
It did change. I mean, one of the things that happens is that 1896, I think one of the things my book doesn't change and doesn't challenge, it's an election in which there's a great deal of realignment. And one of the things I do is I look at 1896, and it doesn't matter who won that election. If Bryan wins as a Democrat, if Bryan wins as a populist, if McKinley wins, all of them agree that the force for change in the United States is going to have to be the federal government, that there's been a consensus that's now forged that the government is going to have to intervene to defuse the situation, that, in fact, there's a kind of private power which cannot go on. And there's going to be various shades of this, but nobody is arguing for laissez-faire. Nobody is arguing for small government. That consensus had been reached. It's just now, what are you going to do with that consensus? So 1896 really does change it. I mean, very often in these kinds of things, McKinley is classed as a reactionary. He's not. You know, he's in many ways going to be a kind of progressive Republican. And that's going to be the future as it goes in. It's going to be Teddy Roosevelt, and it's going to be Bryan, that these guys oppose each other. But compared to the kinds of attitudes that have come out of the end of the Civil War, the kind of old democratic attitudes of small government, that is dead. So that's the thing that really propels it on into the 20th century. The difference, again, is going to be the blockage to that is going to be the courts, and it's going to be a battle over the courts. But that's going to be the beginning of forging of bureaucracies, the kinds of changes, the kinds of ways in which government is going to, in one way or another, regulate industry.
Can I ask a totally different question? But what was it like writing a book of this sort, where you're covering this huge expanse of time, you're trying to cover everything, and yet you're trying to make an argument and to bring coherence, which you do, to the period as a period and to how it defines the nation during that period. How was it writing a book like this? And it's assigned to you in some ways in terms of the period, the years.
Yeah, it was really hard. As a historian, it's a challenge. And, I like the challenge because it is a kind of history, a synthetic history, which I'd never written anything quite like this before. And I had two techniques. I mean, one of the things I did is try to identify the ideas that occur over and over and over again. And one of them was the home. And so this is going to be one of the ideas that drives the book forward. The other one is going to be how Americans think of what an economy should do. And I realized in the 19th century, 19th century Americans, the American dream wasn't great wealth. It was a kind of sufficiency. It was going to be that what you had was enough to support a family, secure your independence. And there was an idea that enough is enough, that the driving for great wealth is not what motivated most Americans. And so once I began to realize these kinds of things, I began to understand what is driving much of the politics. But I needed a guide through it. And one of the things I do is I take William Dean Howells, the novelist, who I don't think is much read anymore, but what Howells was somebody who was connected politically, who knew everybody, who wrote letters, and was somebody who was utterly confused by the period. So what I have is somebody who I can identify with, this kind of confused intellectual trying to figure out what in the world is going on here. And I use Howells to trace the way through his personal tragedies, his reactions to what's going on, his rather ineffective politics, his noble stands that lead to nothing. But he provides me with a guide, and I think a fairly sympathetic guide all the way through. So those were the ways I went about it.
And the title which you chose, The Republic for Which It Stands, a phrase many people instantly recognize. Why did you use that to title the book?
Okay, there's the reason I chose it was because that's what this is about. I mean, what does a republic stand for? I mean, that's precisely what people were fighting about over the time. So this, what seems to be a statement, and it comes from the period because it's a Pledge of Allegiance, is really a question. What is that republic? What I found out since then is the republic for which it stands is most common on right-wing websites. So if you just Google the republic for which it stands, you're not going to get my book. You're
Going to
get all kinds of stuff.
Are they in touch with you?
Sometimes. And this is something else which we knew was going to happen, but I didn't realize the extent. Because I use liberal in the 19th century sense with a small L, a lot of people are thinking I'm talking about liberal with a big L in the 20th century. And so what I'm saying can become sometimes very confused when I read some of the comments about the book.
And during the preparation of the book, at what point did you start thinking, I don't know, or did you, that these forces and these uncertainties of that time seem to be speaking to us with a lot of force today? Is that what it looks like to you?
It was immediate, Sam. I think Julian went down the checklist of all the things that were similar. Yeah, we could extend it indefinitely. It's really hard to avoid that these are sort of parallel universes moving side by side for all the differences between them. There are times when history sort of loops back and you get very close to times in the past. This is a time in the past that's very close to our own.
Well, you said the 1896 election was a time of when it became clear that the federal government ought to be some kind of force for change, and you make it sound as if there was at least that consensus. We don't seem to be quite at that point of consensus right now.
No, we don't. This is the problem with history is while you can find parallels, it doesn't repeat itself.
Plot seems to be going somewhere else at the moment.
Right, but I think as you said yourself, when you look at how the voting is going, I would agree with you. I would agree that the tide is flowing towards a very different United States than the one we have now. I think nobody has articulated quite what the goal is going to be. I mean, one of the things I admired about the Republicans in the 1860s, even though they failed to achieve it, is they had a very clear goal of what their United States was going to be. It was going to be this place of homogeneous citizenship, of a roughly equal, egalitarian nation. They didn't imagine the world they were actually creating, and that way they were totally out of touch, but they had a clear goal. I do not see anybody articulating that clear goal today, nor do I see an ideal, a common ideal which goes across all factions, like the home, which really unites all Americans. So we're not there yet. I'm pretty confident we will get there. I don't think the country will fall apart, but that's the same kind of fear that we have now that they had in the 1880s, 1890s.
Well, on that note, we are going to have to wrap up. Once again, I want to thank our guest, Richard White, one of the great American historians, who is here to discuss his new book, The Republic for Which It Stands, The United States During Reconstruction and the Gilded Age, 1865 to 1896, published by Oxford University Press, and really a fantastic piece of work everyone should have on their bookshelves or their iPads. So thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. I enjoyed it a lot.
Well, that wraps up our episode. Thanks for joining us, and we'll be back soon on Politics and Polls.
Bye, everybody.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series produced by WooCast. This podcast is intended to be informational only and does not reflect nor represent the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.